Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We have a grim, not very sugar-coated assessment of Iraq's chances against its latest threat, ISIS, this hour. Also, are Ukraine and Russia moving into a new phase in their persistent conflict? We'll take a different look at the most recent immigration crisis at the U.S. southern border by traveling well south of that border to El Salvador. And while Washington, D.C. can't yet choose an immigration policy, our own Todd Zwillick found some consensus just in time for tonight's Emmys. We learned the clear preference for D.C.-based TV shows. It's House of Cards versus Veep, folks. But beginning with Iraq, over the weekend there were reports of the White House considering some response to ISIS inside war-torn Syria for the first time. A U.S. journalist hostage, Theo Curtis, was released by an insurgent group in Syria, al-Nusra, after being held for 2 years. There was no ransom paid, said the family. But al-Nusra is a pale cousin of the group, the Islamic State, ISIS, or ISIL, as the White House calls them. We had a deep and candid conversation about ISIS and Iraq's chances against them right now with Ali Kaderi. He's chairman and chief executive of Dragoman Partners. He's served as special assistant to 5 American ambassadors in Iraq and as senior advisor to 3 heads of the Central Command from 2003 to 2010. He says the U.S. needs to take ISIS far more seriously than it ever has taken more familiar al-Qaeda. And he says Iraq may already be out of its league on the battlefield, trying to regain any of the territory it has already lost to ISIS.
Iraq does have a chance, but frankly, it's an increasingly waning chance. And the reason is because the Iraqi government since 2003, particularly over the past 4 years under Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, has chosen to be increasingly divisive and increasingly sectarian and increasingly allied with an alliance that includes Iran, Assad's regime in Syria, and with Hezbollah. And by through the misrule of both Assad in Syria and Maliki in Baghdad, what's happened is a regional sectarian fault line has emerged, and that has disenfranchised the Sunnis in both countries. And that really has opened up a window, as we saw in post-2003 Iraq, for both al-Qaeda and now its supercharged version, which is the Islamic State.
Before we talk about ISIS, do you envision the possibility of Baghdad being the capital of some kind of rump state that's essentially a sort of a province of Iran?
That certainly, frankly, is the odds-on favorite. I think that Prime Minister-designate Abadi and the government in Baghdad has a chance to form an inclusive government and has a chance of doing business in a new way, again, that unites all of Iraqis and makes all Iraqis feel like they have a stake in the future of the country as opposed to its failure. But that chance and those odds, frankly, are just not very high, probably 1 out of 5 in my estimation. And so what is increasingly looking to be more and more likely is that indeed Baghdad, or perhaps even Najaf or Karbala or Basra, one of the other major cities in southern Shia Iraq, will be the capital of a new rump Shia state that's increasingly aligned with Iran and is firmly in Iran's sphere of influence. And then you're looking at the partition of the country into maybe 3 or 4 different parts, a Kurdistan in the north, at least 1 Sunni state in the center. And then again, given the situation in Syria, a very similar situation is almost certain to occur there.
Does the U.S. bear responsibility for this, or was it inevitable? Did the U.S. get out too soon? What do you think about that?
It's a great question, and the answer, as with everything in Iraq and in the Middle East, is complicated. The U.S. certainly bears responsibility, but also, frankly, I think it's very important to highlight both the Iraqi role. I mean, it is their country after all, and they are the primary actors on the ground every day, but also the regional role, and primarily Iran's malign influence in Iraq, going back decades really, but especially since 2003, since they have armed, trained, equipped, and otherwise organized the creation of Iraq's Shia Islamist militias, and even they've cooperated with al-Qaeda occasionally. And they really sought to do that to destabilize Iraq, to keep it weak and divided, so that the mullahs in Tehran could continue to wield a tremendous amount of influence over the Iraqis, really as sort of a big brother. that is something that's not often enough touched upon, but really is a major force of the continuing instability that we see across really the entire Middle East, from Lebanon and their role with Hezbollah to, again, the genocide that's occurring in Syria at the hands of Assad, Hezbollah, the Iraqi militias, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. And we're even beginning to see signs of that in Afghanistan, where the Iranians are playing a major destabilizing role.
Do you think the U.S. airstrike policy, which seems to have stabilized the situation between ISIS and the Kurds, is something that has to be in place more or less indefinitely? Or is it the U.S. responsibility, and do they even have the capability of rolling back ISIS in some way by actually entering the conflict?
Again, the answer is complicated. The American airstrikes in Iraq are frankly nothing more than a pinprick. They are a couple of Tylenol tablets to address a headache that has been caused by a cancer, which is, again, the misrule from Maliki's government in Baghdad and Assad's misrule in Damascus. The root cause of this cancer, ISIS, is the sectarian policies and, again, the genocide that we've seen in Syria and Maliki's misrule and alienation of the Sunnis in Iraq. And so really, what we're talking about with these airstrikes are tactics, not strategy. It's why, frankly, recently in an open letter to President Obama, I have begged him to adopt a coherent Middle East strategy, to appoint, for example, an American five-star general as a modern-day General Eisenhower, as a czar for the Middle East. Because what we really need is we need a coherent strategy. We need to work very closely with our regional allies, because that is really the only viable solution for beginning to address the underlying factors that have given rise to ISIS. And frankly, it's very important to explicitly say that only Sunni Arabs from across the Middle East, and principally from Syria and Iraq itself, or themselves, only they can roll back ISIS in their countries. No foreign military force, especially modern-day crusaders in the form of Western militaries like the American Army, they will never be able to roll back ISIS or al-Qaeda anywhere in the world, because they're seen as modern-day crusaders in a very bad light. They're viewed as Christian armies coming in to the heart of the Islamic world. And frankly, if that were to happen again, if you were to see boots on the ground again anywhere in the Middle East, all that would do is it would help embolden and strengthen and finance al-Qaeda or ISIS's efforts.
So if the U.S. Doesn't move into Iraq again, how does ISIS grow? It can't be by the occasional beheading of Western journalists or, you know, slaughtering villagers, ethnic cleansing. What do? Go after Israel or send suicide bombers to Paris and L.A.?
The short answer is a combination of all of the above. Again, what we've seen with ISIS is that it is truly a supercharged version of al-Qaeda. It is the al-Qaeda that bin Laden could have only dreamed of in 2001 before orchestrating the attacks of 9/11, in that it is winning on every front so far. It is, as a result of those victories, able to recruit tens of thousands of new fighters, not from only across the Islamic world, but also from Western countries, like in Europe and the United States. And as a result of these victories, it is now a self-financing organization, because it has captured several oil fields in Syria and in Iraq. They're not major ones, but according to some estimates I've seen, ISIS is now selling up to 100,000 barrels of oil a day to actually Assad himself and to the locals in these provinces. So we're talking about $10 million a day of revenue generation potentially for ISIS. And obviously you can do a lot with that, given that bin Laden staged 9/11 with only $500,000 and a couple dozen operatives. So ISIS now again has a war chest of hundreds of millions of dollars potentially. They have hundreds of millions of dollars worth of U.S. military equipment that they seize when the Iraqi army, you know, dissipated. And they have thousands of very eager young fighters from around the world, hundreds, perhaps thousands of which or whom have Western passports. And so these sleeper cells in major Western European cities like Paris or London or Rome, or potentially in the United States, it's not an issue of if they come, it's simply an issue of when they will strike in the West.
Well, that's comforting. What's the U.S. response?
The only viable U.S. response has to be, number one, President Obama and other senior administration officials need to be very honest with the American people that we are at war. I know that Americans are war-weary, they're tired, and frankly, I don't blame them. Myself, having served over 2,000 days in Iraq, I'm quite tired of war myself, but the reality is you don't get to choose if and when your enemy comes after you. If they tell you, for example, that we will fly the ISIS flag over the White House, or, quote, you will drown in pools of your own blood. And they have promised both things. They have said, we will see you in New York. And I think, frankly, we should take them at their word, given bin Laden's promises to attack the homeland years before 9/11 occurred. So the only viable American response has to be, again, being honest with the American people, being honest with ourselves. The president should stop calling ISIS the junior varsity team. His deputy national security advisor only last week said on CNN that ISIS is not a threat to the homeland and is not a threat to American interests. That's patently false. We should be honest, number one. Number two, we need a coherent regional strategy. Number three, we really do need a Middle East czar to work on a daily basis with our regional allies to share intelligence, to share military assets, to work together to reach a diplomatic conclusion to some of these threats. And we just, as Americans, have to unite and understand that this is going to be a long, costly campaign, but it's one that we have no choice in addressing. We can either pull back everyone and just wait for another 9/11, or we can take the fight directly to the enemy.
Ali Kaderi, Chairman and Chief Executive of Dragoman Partners. He served as special assistant to five American ambassadors in Iraq and as senior advisor to three heads of the Central Command from 2003 to 2010. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Later this hour, are you watching the Emmys tonight? You may not have a vote for the winners, but the folks in D.C. have some strong opinions on shows about our nation's capital.
If you cover the White House, there are three questions that you always get and you always have to be prepared for. One is, what's the president really like? Two is, have you ever ridden on Air Force One? And three is, what do you think of popular political drama X?
Our own Todd Zwillick stepped into the political drama of finding out how the Beltway gang feels about their portrayal in TV's Veep and House of Cards. And we're asking you this hour, what TV show topped your list this year?
Hey, this is Eric Metz from Dallas, Texas. My favorite show had to be Cosmos. The original series and the accompanying book literally changed my life. So I had high hopes that the new one would inspire another generation. And I wasn't disappointed at all.
One adventure with many heroes.
One of you from Statesville, North Carolina said this, it was the most satisfying end possible to a masterpiece of the small screen about, you guessed it, Breaking Bad. What TV show deserves a trophy from you? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and be part of the conversation, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway while coming up here on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
What you are hearing is the sound of the latest U.S. immigration and border crisis in reverse. Buses bringing migrants caught in Mexico heading north to the USA back to villages and cities in El Salvador, apprehended or deported by the authorities. Increased deportation has been one of the U.S. responses for hundreds of women and children fleeing violence and poverty in Central America. So far, three planes have left the U.S. for El Salvador. Kate Sheehy, reporter for KJZZ News, has been investigating the situation in San Salvador, where disappointed and fearful parents and children have been sent due to a stalled immigration reform effort in Washington.
We know that a couple planes have arrived from the U.S. over the last few months, which has been mothers and their children. But there are also lots of people arriving by bus from Mexico, and several buses are arriving a couple times a week at a migrant processing center in the capital here.
Are these people heartbroken? What's the reception like for people and the circumstances of the deportations, as far as you can understand it?
Well, it's a mix. I mean, a lot of the families are relieved to have their loved ones back and know that they're okay. There seems to be disappointment that they didn't make it, that they got caught in Mexico on their way to the U.S., but also relieved that they're safe and they made it home in one piece.
What about the fear of gang violence that has really surrounded and motivated these people to come north to begin with? They're going right back to it. What have you found?
Yes, definitely. And that's where the fear remains. Talking to mothers and their kids here who just are at a loss of what they're supposed to do now. They have to find a place often to take their kid after they get back because it's not safe for them to go back to their neighborhood where they left because people know that they left. A lot of times they're leaving because of gang threats, sometimes even in their schools. So there's definitely that fear of, you know, what do we do now because there's not a safe place to go back to.
Here you are stuck. What can I do? I can't do anything. Only the government can help these boys.
Tell me a little bit about who that woman is, and is the government helping anyone?
That's one of the mothers that we spoke to who was waiting to pick up her son who had left because of gang threats within his school, pressure to join gangs. And actually, when she went into the Migrant Processing Center to pick up her son, she had to do a brief interview with a government organization. And they told her that if her son tried to leave again, she could get her son taken away. And it made her feel like a bad mother. But she was in tears to us saying, but what am I supposed to do? There's nothing I can do to protect him. Only the government can help. And really, the sense that we got from most of these people is frustration with the government, that they're choosing to ignore how so many people live here in fear and poverty and with violence in their daily lives.
Well, it's so surprising that there would be a sense of tension between these families and the government when there's such a palpable sense of fear among young people. Here's a young man, Eduardo Rodriguez.
I don't have confidence in the police to do anything because there are police who are part of the gangs.
And he's a young man who hasn't even left. He's not become a migrant yet. He's just living in this fear.
Right. My colleague spoke to him in a town. This was in another town outside of the capital. And he was describing how terrifying it is to be a child in that neighborhood and the kind of things that he sees on a daily basis. Death, kidnappings, threats, and that, yeah, he feels like there's no security. There's nobody that he can turn to.
Kate, we've seen the infrastructure in the United States from the migration northward overwhelm the infrastructure in the U.S. at the border and elsewhere. What kind of infrastructure are you seeing in El Salvador to get these returnees?
There's definitely a sense here that, you know, the U.S. is wanting to send back families and kids, but that the government is not prepared for that. Now, they say they are trying to prepare. They are trying to collaborate between different government organizations and even NGOs to provide the resources and space that are needed to greet these kids and repatriate these kids when they arrive. But right now, they're not there. The facility I visited at the airport called Bienvenido a Casa, the government official I spoke to was telling me, see, there's just not enough space here to receive kids because when kids come home, there's so many different organizations that need to be involved. For example, kids receive a psychological evaluation to see what kind of trauma they have and, you know, if they have a safe place to return to. And also with the migrant processing center that we visited, other people I spoke to, volunteers that are working there, say, you know, people get there and they just want to leave because there's not enough space. It's just kind of chaotic. And they want to really make it a place where people feel safe and can even stay for a couple days, take a shower, see a pediatrician, but they're not there yet.
Finally, Kate, in your time in El Salvador, do you get the sense that the nation itself is unstable and
filled with, you know, something approaching chaos? Because that's the story that we're hearing from people who are moving north from these Central American countries, that there's just no way for them to be safe in their own country.
Well, yeah, and I also lived here for 6 months. So I've visited many neighborhoods that are very poor, that are not safe, where it's not safe to be out and about and living freely, especially as a youth and even more so as a male child, because even the police and other adults often suspect that young men, boys, are part of a gang, and they're afraid of them before they even know who they are and what they're about. So they have the fear from the gangs, and then they don't receive support from their communities. It's a struggle for a lot of these people just on a daily basis to put food in their mouths and then also have to deal with the insecurity. And a lot of these communities, especially in the rural areas, are very isolated and they don't have support and help out there or anywhere to turn.
So instability in El Salvador and a lack of clarity in immigration policy in the U.S. and the people that you're speaking with there in El Salvador caught in the middle. Kate, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Kate Shee is a reporter for KJZZ in San Salvador, El Salvador.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
Has this year's recent immigration reform initiative in Congress been moved along by the latest influx of Central American migrants fleeing violence in their home countries? Reform-minded Republicans on Capitol Hill seem to have gone silent since the surprise defeat of former Senate Majority Leader and immigration reform supporter Eric Cantor by a Tea Party upstart. So where do things stand between lawmakers and impatient White House and the business community seeking immigration clarity right now? We turn to Fernando Pizarro, Washington correspondent for Univision. Fernando, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me again.
So have the latest headlines, the latest Central American, pictures of young people coming to the southern border changed anything in Washington, as far as you can tell?
Well, as you know, Washington seems to be at a standstill while President and both Congress are away. The president comes back this week from his vacation. But right now, there seems to be no action when it comes to solving this issue at all. You may remember that Congress left without necessarily fixing this issue or providing the necessary funds to address the crisis. When it comes to the executive actions that are expected and announced by President Obama back in June 30th, everybody is kind of in a waiting mode to see what the White House decide what to do. Everything we've seen in media reports lately are either leaks, small leaks, or speculation of what the White House may do. The White House repeatedly, to us, to other media, to many people, keeps on saying, we haven't made a decision, we haven't made a decision, we're still looking. They're holding meetings with business groups, they're holding meetings with advocacy and stakeholders to see how far they can go, but they are still waiting for a so-called report or evaluation by DHS Secretary Jay Johnson.
So the ball is still in the air as far as the White House is concerned. They're interested in the issue, but I'm wondering how the business community is running out of patience here in terms of they want clarity, right?
Yes. Well, of course, the White House seems very interested in the issue. The question is, when will this happen? Another thing that has to do with Congress, that we're hearing rumblings that the Senate Democrats are a little concerned about the timing of this announcement, and they may want this announcement after the November election. Some other people say, no, that's not a good idea. We need to help the Democrats. This is from advocacy groups and, of course, members of Congress in the House that are a little worried about their own races. So we will have to see what happens when it comes to that, to the timing of the announcement and the range of how far the White House is willing to go. When it comes to the business community, remember that the business community has for long demanded and been behind a comprehensive immigration reform, and they want basically low-skilled and high-skilled visas, temporary visas for workers to bring them in and to use, you know, to be employees of their companies. What they've been thinking and proposing is that maybe some unused green cards, that happens because a lot of countries under a lot of quotas when giving green cards, especially for family reunification and other countries that have high levels of immigration to the U.S., go unused, that those get transferred to work permits for spouses of workers that are here. So that could solve some issues for the business community and make them happy while we're waiting for some executive action on the president. But that issue alone does not address at all the issue of undocumented immigration and the situation of deportations that many of the advocacy groups are asking for relief for all these months.
Do advocacy groups think this is going to be pushed off for another electoral cycle?
No, the advocacy groups that favor that the president gives some relief for deportations, they are afraid and they are totally against the notion that this gets pushed back. The rumblings that we're hearing is that the Senate Democrats are a little concerned about their other options in the Senate come November, that they may be pushing for the White House to push it back. But the advocacy groups as a whole or in general, they prefer that this gets done the sooner rather than later.
Fernando Pizarro, Washington correspondent for Univision. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
What if the folks in Washington picked the Emmys that are scheduled tonight? Lord knows we wouldn't want to burden them with another responsibility, right? They're so busy doing virtually nothing. But try this.
It's the Washington, D.C. Emmy Awards. And the award for the best portrayal of a character from Washington politics.
There are actually some strong candidates here. HBO's Veep is nominated for Best Comedy. And for the binge-loving, nasty, backstabbing House of Cards from Netflix, there's a nomination for Best Drama. TV loves D.C., and viewers love their TV D.C., even if they don't much care for the real-life cast of Inside the Beltway. But do people in the Beltway like how they're portrayed? We put this to Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick and his sources in the White House on Capitol Hill. Hi, Todd.
Hi, John.
If they were to call the roll at the Emmys on Capitol Hill, who would win?
Well, we're about to find out because this year at the Emmys is really the year, John, where they're showing how much America loves political shows. House of Cards is nominated for 10 awards. Veep is nominated for 8. And as much as political operators and journalists like to think their issues and their stories is what reach the public, it's really the fictionalized versions that most people see. Olivier Knox is White House correspondent and Washington bureau chief for Yahoo News, a 12-year veteran of the White House beat.
If you cover the White House, there are three questions that you always get and you always have to be prepared for. One is, what's the president really like? Two is, have you ever ridden on Air Force One? And three is, what do you think of popular political drama X?
And this goes back a long way, right?
Yeah. Oh, it does. It goes all the way back to the West Wing and before. And in this case, John, popular political drama X, as Olivier Knox was saying, is House of Cards.
He chose money over power. In this town, a mistake nearly everyone makes.
And the show has it all. It has scheming and has plotting and sex and murder, tons of intricate congressional maneuvering. But you know what it doesn't have, John? It doesn't have a lot of love among Washington's political class.
Really?
Olivier Knox told me that he lost interest after a few minutes of the pilot. The characters, he said, entertaining, but too competent, too good at what they do. Not realistic. In fact, John, unscientific poll, I put the House of Cards versus Veep question out on a listserv that's frequented by political professionals and journalists. I got about 50 replies.
That's pretty good.
But 95% of them, Veep.
You may never meet her personally. She may never catch your eye or ever thank you. But Selina Meyer will never forget you.
You are going to change America in a way that usually only war and fluoride can.
I'm Jess McIntosh. I'm a Democratic operative. I work in communications. Literally nobody who doesn't work in politics has ever asked me if my life is like Veep. It is like Veep. Our lives are not like House of Cards. There is really nothing that House of Cards presents other than the names of certain Washington locations that bear any relation to reality. Whereas Veep is sometimes so painful to watch because it is so close to things that have happened in my world that I'm aware that it's funny, but I can't possibly laugh at it. It's our lives are Veep.
My name's Tim Miller. I'm the executive director of America Rising PAC, which is basically a Republican opposition research super PAC. I come down very strongly in favor of Veep.
It's an honor. I actually wrote it in my diary and stared at it for a full 5 minutes.
My tweet for you.
John, Tim Miller told me that Veep portrays the real lives of political operatives in uncanny ways. You know, a world that's small and insular, where people really do tend to fail upward. Like Mike McClintock, the Veep's press secretary on the show.
All right, I gotta get going. I gotta go make noises out of my face hole or whatever it is I do.
The guy's bad at his job, but he's still around after two decades. And there are political moments that also make handlers cringe. The uncomfortable meet and greets with half-interested voters. The photo op that just doesn't gel for Selina Meyer.
She goes to Britain and, you know, she's at the ball. She's at the bar and she's drinking this enormous, you know, glass of warm beer, and she hates beer, and she has to fake it, was very reminiscent of, you know, watching our nominee, Governor Romney, last time on the campaign trail, where all of a sudden you get in these photo op situations where you just have no ability to navigate it in a normal fashion.
What am I having? What would you recommend that I have at this lovely place?
How about a nice Pinot Noir?
Oh, that sounds divine.
I'm joking.
It.
No, that's no. He won't. I think to me you look like a bitter person. Maybe. Don't worry. It's just a joke. Just playing.
Bitter is a horrible beer.
Well, she's gonna drink it and she's gonna smile.
A lot of these people feel like their lives are featured in Veep. But I found something else interesting. You know, among the political people I talked to, a lot of Veep lovers, but also House of Cards haters. And this was actually not so funny. John, a lot of women that I spoke to in town, especially journalists, said that since House of Cards got popular, they've been asked to answer for one Zoe Barnes.
Do you have a man who cares for you? An older man?
No.
But you've been with older men before?
Yes.
Then you know they hurt you. And after they hurt you, they discard you.
You can't hurt me.
And Kate Nocera has been on Capitol Hill for about 5 years. She works for BuzzFeed.
Ha ha, have you ever slept with any of your sources? That was not a question that existed in my world before the show, and now it happens all the time. Whether it's a joke or not, it's still offensive, and I immediately kind of tense up when someone says that. People have been surprised, too, when they've asked it, how mad I get.
John, Kate Nocera is not alone in this. Meredith Shiner of Yahoo News told me that she gets, okay, that Hollywood shows need sex, but she wishes that weren't the only thing that people think about when they talk about her political career.
Being a woman here and the job that I do is difficult no matter what, and this sort of has fueled into it because it brings outsiders to that same perspective that I think is unfortunately cast by insiders too.
Well, you can certainly see that the unflattering portrait on House of Cards rubs people the wrong way. I can understand that, male or female. But aren't there people on Capitol Hill who dream of having the power of a Frank Underwood?
Well, let me introduce you to Susan Davis. She doesn't want power, but she covers power and has for a long time. She's the congressional correspondent for USA Today. She's covered Congress and elections since 2002, a real veteran. Now, Susan says she doesn't like the Zoe Barnes portrayal either, but Frank Underwood, to her, is actually an aspirational figure.
You need forceful, dominant, strong personalities who know how to govern. I've never witnessed a politician in this Congress today who I think is as cunning or as smart or as capable of governing as someone like a Frank Underwood would be.
I've always loathed the necessity of sleep. Like death, it puts even the most powerful men on their backs.
If anything, it's frustrating to see how incapable so many of these people are.
So we're living in the Veep era in Washington, and we'll only fix government if we get into the Underwood era, perhaps.
That's what Susan Davis is really saying. There are no more Lyndon Johnsons, no more Tom DeLays, no more results-oriented, if not ruthless, political operators in Washington, and she's kind of longing for that. But I got to leave it with Jess McIntosh, the Democratic operative that we heard from before.
Those characters on Veep think they're on House of Cards. They're doing the Machiavellian thing. They're trying to one-up everybody else on their team and get ahead, and it always fails. And that's basically what happens in Washington. If you're trying to play three-dimensional chess, you're going to forget that you have a really important job to do, and you're going to fall down on it, and then everybody's going to laugh at you.
She's dead on.
Everybody loves Jess. The laughter of Veep, all too real for a lot of people in Washington, D.C., John.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. A cameo on Veep in your future?
Well, John, if they're going to give me one, I'd rather it be on House of Cards. Veep is apparently all too real.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, handing the Inside the Beltway Emmy to Veep. So what show would you give an Emmy Award to this year? We'd love to know. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on our program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.